Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today we hear from community organizations as they navigate federal freezes in climate spending. The uncertainty continues. And we talk with a retired Supreme Court justice from Canada why constitutional issues matter. The trailblazer is set to appear at the University of Hawaii Law School tonight. We also hear from Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi about a new addition to his cabinet to tackle homelessness, as well as efforts to finalize the Oahu landfill site. A new physician's assistant program in Hawaii Pacific University hopes to help fill the state's health care needs. We get the details. Plus, we've got a Manu Minute for you. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been a wild ride in the first weeks of the Trump administration. It has been stop and go for some federal funds in the pipeline, but access to financial portals that were frozen have not all been reinstated. HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us to talk about what programs are affected. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what'd you find out?
Along with many people at Hawaii Public Radio, I've been tracking the impact of funding freezes on local agencies and organizations, and I've been looking at what this means for climate and justice work. And the people that I've talked to are still expressing a lot of concern and confusion over some grants that continue to be frozen. One of them is the Kapapahuliau Climate Resilience Program. This is administered by the Department of Interior's Office of Native Hawaiian Relations, and it's $20 million that was funded through the Inflation Reduction Act that in October announced 17 different Native Hawaiian organizations that had been awarded grants for climate work. And all of the projects in this program are really unique. So, for instance, there's one that a church is doing that is helping to protect Na'iwi Kupuna or ancestral burial sites that have been exposed by climate impacts, not the type of program that we see funded in other instances. But unfortunately, the work of these programs has been stopped in its tracks since Trump's return to office. So multiple Kapapahuliau recipients have confirmed to HBR that they are unable to draw down the grant funding intended for their projects. That includes the Pu'a Foundation, which was incorporated in 1996 as part of the reconciliation process of the United Church of Christ participation in the illegal overthrow of Queen Liliuokalani. And so that organization does a lot of work to address overrepresentation of Native Hawaiians in jails and prisons, but it also stewards the Punahoa Heritage Forest outside of Hilo on Hawaii Island. And I spoke with Toni Bisson, Pua's executive director, and she told me that when she saw the Kapapahuliau grant, she felt like it was just perfect for the work that they wanted to do to preserve this heritage forest. So they applied. They were awarded just shy of $800,000 last October. Bisson said it was the largest award the organization had ever received. And the bulk of that money was supposed to go to create a fence around 380 acres of old-growth ohia forest to keep out destructive invasive species like feral pits. But before Bisson was able to draw down even a single dollar of that grant, it was frozen. And that's the result of an executive order that Trump issued on his very first day back in office, halting the disbursement of Inflation Reduction Act funds. Here's Bisson talking about the impact.
Sometimes we think about what's happening in the news and things happening in Washington, D.C., like so far away and so distant. But there is a direct response from that executive order, and it happened so fast, and there's such confusion. It is extremely frustrating and chaotic. It feels like a punch in the gut. It feels like a punch in the face. And so how are we responding? Do we respond in anger or do, not that we take it, but we have to be smart.
So how is the foundation regrouping?
So Bisson says they're exploring their options, including other sources of funding, but they do have the ability to wait it out for a little bit. She thinks that they can manage to go without the funding for the next 6 months without shelving this project. But other organizations that I've talked to, don't have that same flexibility. So one is the Ho'omahua Foundation, which is also a recipient of the Kapapahuliau grant. It's a small nonprofit that works with kids in Waianae on the west side of Oahu, and they were awarded more than $900,000 to support a cohort of students engaged in climate work. But now that that funding is paused, their executive director, Camille Hampton, says the organization is trying to find other sources of funding to be able to pay those students.
A big component of the project is actually student stipends. Part of our programming is to be able to help students financially for participating with this learning experience, as opposed to going out and having to get a part-time job, which is really important for a lot of the participants in our programs, at least. You know, that extra income for their families is important for them. You know, trying to figure out, like, what do we do? We have 25 students and 5 teachers who have been doing all this work already, you know, if we can't find funding. So that's really stressful.
Yeah, just upended with no notice.
Yeah, so they're hoping to have clarity on when the funding will be thawed by the end of February. So if they need to, they can help those students find other work. And there are other grants that are in limbo as well. One is the Environmental Justice Thriving Communities Grant Program, which is through the Environmental Protection Agency. And that was supposed to fund projects in communities that have been disproportionately affected by pollutants and environmental degradation. Applicants from Hawaii, which is part of EPA's Region 9, would have had a chance to vie for about $50 million. And that application opened just a few days before Trump was inaugurated. I spoke with Davis Price. He's from Oahu and works with the Indian Collective. And that is an organization led by Native Americans that was brought on to this program to help with outreach to really get different proposals from indigenous communities. And Price says that while the applications for that grant are open, the grant administrators, at least in Region 9, which includes Hawaii, can't actually access any of that money. It's been frozen since the Federal Office of Management and Budget issued a memo to pause payments for federal grants and programs.
We're working with multiple regions, and so all those different regional grant makers' experience was a little different. Some were frozen right away that day when the memo came out, which was the 27th or 28th, when that first really broad-reaching memo was notifying folks that everything would be cut off, the government-wide freeze at 5 p.m. that day. I think Region 9 was frozen at 5 p.m. on that day. But to my knowledge, and from what I'm hearing in our work with other regions, and the regional grant makers who are in the same position that have direct access to the federal funds, they have not been told to stop the program. It is a pause. And because there's contracts in place, the hope is that the federal government will hold up the end of its deal with respect to those contracts and allow the work to go forward. So grantees, what we're sharing with potential applicants is to still apply.
Yeah, it's such a strange and unsettling time because there is just so much uncertainty.
And the folks that I've talked to don't have good explanations for why their grants will be frozen or when they will be released. And for some folks, it's been very start and stop. So something that we've seen on the state side, the Hawaii Green Infrastructure Authority has been locked out of $62 million in Solar for All funds. That's from the Environmental Protection Agency to help low-income communities get rooftop solar. And that was briefly thawed last Friday, but then as of this week has been frozen again. We're also seeing impacts to the State Climate Commission. They released in a newsletter last week that they may have to lay off 5 positions, that they have 4 open contracts that they cannot bill for services rendered, and they can't finalize the contract for the statewide climate action plan due to frozen Environmental Protection Agency funds. When I followed up with them for more information, DLNR said they can't comment further because our attorney general is involved in one of the legislation about these frozen funds.
Yeah, it's really a tough position to be in. But thank you so much for ferreting this out and in tracking this. But thanks again, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HR Savannah Harriman Poe. Look for her stories on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Live from the Atherton, this weekend, HPR presents the Malie Lehman Quartet. This concert is a part of HPR's Mele Hawaii performance series. The Malie Lehman Quartet is performing this Saturday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton, sponsored by HMSA.
This morning, we sat down with a former Supreme Court Justice on Canada's High Court, Rosalie Silberman Abella. Her legal career is stellar. The first Jewish woman and refugee to sit on the court, she gives us a different point of view of Canada's origins and its interpretation of equity. She's to appear this evening at the University of Hawaii Law School as part of the Better Tomorrow Speaker Series. Canada has been in the headlines as President Donald Trump suggested that it should be the next state added to the U.S. of A. Abella helps us understand the differences in our democracies.
The constitutional origins of democracy came from the United States. But the way the constitutional frameworks have developed are very, very different. So your constitution is a couple of hundred years old. Canada is like Germany and now South Africa and Israel and the European Court of Human Rights, one of the post-World War II liberal democratic constitutions with our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which we got in 1982. So you had always had a constitutional protection of rights, and the jurisprudence that developed under that old constitution is still guiding the Americans. We came out of the gate in 1982 with a totally different approach to rights and freedoms based on a different world view since World War II. So the whole thrust after World War II was the protection of rights and preventing discrimination and having a democratic framework where the understanding was the public elected governments. Governments were responsive to those publics. The majority won. And the consequence of not being responsive to the public was you lose your seat. The courts are the independent protectors of the Constitution, the guardians of the Constitution, as our Chief Justice said in 1982. And they are there to be able, independently, without the consequence of losing their jobs, to protect minorities. So that's number one, a very clear understanding of the democratic framework, which is majorities elect governments, courts, independent courts, protect the guardrails that ensure that government stays within the Constitution and protects the rights that are in there. So not only did that happen resolutely in Canada, we developed our own approach to rights. For instance, key difference, the 14th Amendment, which is the equality amendment in the United States, treats equality as sameness. It's an Aristotelian theory of rights, treating likes alike. So treating all pregnant women alike, treating all non-whites alike, treating all persons with disabilities alike. Canada's approach to equality, when it interpreted it for the first time, was acknowledging differences so that people could be treated as equals, accommodating the differences. So if you are a person with disabilities, you need a wheelchair. If you're treated the same, you don't get a wheelchair because you're treated like everybody else. So the model is not the melting pot, an assimilation model, which doesn't work anyway because the idea that everybody's the same is just really theoretically and in fact non-existent. So we have integration based on difference, hyphenated, Italian-Canadian, Jewish-Canadian, except Indigenous people who were the first Canadians.
Well, how are you viewing what's going on here in the United States? Because it seems like people just woke up one morning and all of a sudden equity is like a four-letter word.
Well, this is so aberrational to a Canadian because, as I just explained to you, difference is the core of our model. I mean, the people at the constitutional table when Canada was formed were English and French. And the constitutional bargain they made was that they could retain their differences and still be considered as equal. That was the whole framework of our original constitution before we added the rights protections in 1982. So you have, I think, in your DNA in America, because it wandered over from King George III and escape from those repressive theories, the idea from Hobbes and Locke and Hume and John Stuart Mill, the idea that every individual had the same right as every other individual to be free from an unreasonable state. So the core identity in the United States is the individual. But Canada also recognizes group membership and says your rights as an individual vis-a-vis the state, those civil libertarian rights, the right to be free from an unreasonable state, exist. But so do your group rights, your human rights, how you're treated because you are a woman or are a person of color or a person with disabilities or a person with different gender identities. So we accommodate all of that in addition to the civil liberties rights. So we group rights are human rights. And the individual rights are civil liberties. We have both. There's an inability, I think, in the United States really to understand the role that group identity plays. So when you say anti-DEI, I think a good argument could be made in many settings about the methodology that's been used sometimes, about the pace, about whether the implementation of the idea of DEI worked properly. But the idea that you eliminate any attempt to try to include people who had been left out, to me, is bizarre. It's the whole post-World War II framework. And to call fairness a partisan issue, it makes no sense to me at all.
The last few weeks have been jarring. How do you get across to our listeners why these constitutional issues matter? I mean, I don't know what your fear is when you see what's going on and you look at our headlines day after day.
I fear the complete elimination of guardrails. I mean, there's a reason that you've developed in this country and you were leaders for around the world of what the democratic framework looked like and what institutions looked like. And the processes that were required for people to lose their liberty, to lose their jobs, to lose their rights. There are processes in place and independent courts to monitor it, which seems to be happening. I'm really happy to see the courts stepping up. But, you know, I'm not a fan of the phrase rule of law because you could say that segregation was under the rule of law. And I know that lawyers have a very sophisticated approach, but the rule of law, at the very least, meant that there were protections from arbitrary rule. And what seems to be happening with respect is that the rule of law and justice is being replaced by the rule of whim and intimidation.
The other night I was looking at the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, in the line, and justice for all. And I just wonder if that is really going to be the case going forward.
Well, the other thing that's happened in this country, and it's not mine, so I'm a visitor and I have to say I'm looking from 10,000 feet and I really am not on the ground. So I defer to the expertise of those who know much more than I do. But when I see what's going on and the cavalier disrespect for institutional history and accepted rules of respect and dignity, I worry because courts take a long time. They are doing their best. But what is a little bit surprising to me, and maybe it's because people are still trying to absorb what's happening, I don't see the big organizational groups. I can see why individuals worry about what the consequences are of standing up. But where are the big organizations, legal, religious, business, saying, wait, this is not what we set up the United States to do? And that scares me, that there isn't an outcry because so far it's not happening to them. But when you have a world that doesn't care what vulnerable people are experiencing, then that's a world that is losing its humanity. And a world that loses its humanity goes back to the world I was born into. I was born in 1946 to parents who survived the Holocaust, born in a DP camp, and raised in a house that said, now we're in a country of Canada where there's freedom, where there are rights, we don't have to worry anymore. And I took that for granted. And Canada in particular was a country of an increasing trajectory of inclusion. More and more bringing people in we realized we had left out.
I heard this week someone express concern about what you email because they may use AI to ferret out folks who may not agree with the administration's policies. And I just worry about that because I was thinking of what happened in Syria where people were so afraid to think out loud, to say anything. And so that's a bit scary.
Well, the fact that you're using Syria in the same sentence as what's going on in the United States is very alarming. I mean, is that something you would have thought even possible? So when you go beyond, as I think you may have, an ordinary partisan divide, we saw you split in this country into two groups who did not listen to each other and didn't listen to anybody who wasn't within their silo. When you go into a hegemonic approach, I'm right, I'm the only one who's right, and I will do everything I can to stop you from thinking differently, acting differently. Ideological compliance is not the United States of America. Well, it was under Joseph McCarthy, but now, 2025, so it's a bit science fiction to see what's happening, but it's real. It's not a script. It's not a novel. And people are losing rights without process, without the fairness guardrails so that they at least know why what is happening to them is happening to them. And there may, I'm not saying because I don't know whether there aren't substantive things that need to be remedied in the delivery of government services, but a remedy is different from an elimination, an obliteration, and it's just gone. And to instill in the American public fear of its own government, vulnerable people as the enemy of the people, is shocking, I have to say.
Shocking. That was the viewpoint of Rosalie Silberman Abila. She retired as Supreme Court Justice of Canada's High Court in 2021, and she's a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. She joined us in studio earlier this morning. She's to give a free public talk tonight at the Richardson School of Law, starting at 6:30 p.m. We will have a link to the event on our website after the show. You know, this morning we spoke with Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi. He feels a sense of urgency in his second term and as we begin this new year to tackle our homeless and housing crisis. He announced a new director of Homeless Solutions, who will start later this month. Roy Miyahira will replace Sam Moku as Blangiardi's homeless czar.
Our housing strategy and what the city's role is in it and the creation of that housing and the intended occupants of that is not the same as our homeless strategy. Our homeless strategy is a entirely different operation and with respect to beds that we've created, and for that matter, in 2024, we created 1,500 beds. We're about to open up Evelay Center. There will be 100 new beds in that area in addition to the success we've had at Ala Respite. So I just want to be really clear about that, and that's part of the reason why in bringing Roy on board, all that we've learned, now that we're in this really highly collaborative mode with the state, between he and John Mizuno, who I think has the title of homeless coordinator at the state level, they become point people for us from the standpoint of there are a lot of logistics involved. I learned now in our efforts to do the things we're doing, to be able to put beds in Kahale, it's really a logistical job. And I want to be able to hold people to timelines and ensure that we don't run into unnecessary delays. That was been really my biggest frustration. So let me give you a little bit of context about where I am in life right now. Not that you asked me.
Okay.
Just so happens, by great coincidence, Catherine, today marks 5 years from the day that I said I was going to run for mayor, February 12th, 2020. As I reflect, I've been doing it over the last couple of days on where we are as we begin our second term. When I reflect upon how fast these 5 years have gone by, probably in some ways accelerated because of the incredible challenges brought on with COVID, not just in trying to run for mayor 3 weeks after I announced. But then everything that ensued in our very first year of taking office and all the challenges, unique challenges, time-consuming challenges, challenges that we don't even deal with anymore now that we're fully operational, although there are residual impacts. But I think back about how fast these 5 years have been, knowing that already we're halfway through month number 47 in the second term, you know, I have a real sense of urgency. That's my point. I've said it repeatedly to my team, we're picking up the pace, not because of anything that the public expects from us. It's because of what we expect from ourselves and the capability of this team.
What does Roy bring to the table? Why is he a good fit?
Well, because he had a tremendous background in working exactly through logistics and other kinds of really a lot of people work. He has just a really good skill set coming from Nestle. The guy is really brilliant. He's come back to Hawaii. He's a local guy. And in all of our articulation and what he wants to do, he doesn't want to be retired. He came back home with a purpose. It involves his family and his parents. But everything we liked about him, this is a guy and everything we found out about him who can connect the dots, if you know what I mean. And so in that regard, we're very excited about that. I know now what we need in that position. What I hear, you know, it's sitting on somebody's desk waiting for signature. I want somebody to go to that desk, get that signature, and bring it back and make it happen. That's the kind of stuff that I want to go on. That wasn't going on before. And it's not certainly anything on Sam who left for personal family reasons. This just has to do with what I said at the outset. My sense of urgency, my sense of priority, understanding the absolute crisis we're in with respect to housing and homelessness, and having people in this office I could look at and say, get it done, and I know they'll get it done. That's where this is coming from.
I do have to say, you know, in driving around, I know there were some problem areas there on Kapi'olani and also over in front of the agriculture department. Very scary for the employees in that area, and the state and city's efforts to keep that area safe is good.
And the good news is we're no longer doing the thing with just, you know, pick up their stuff, tell them to get off the sidewalk, go store it somewhere. We, you know, when I mentioned the fact we put 1,500 beds into play last week, the collaboration with the state allows us to do the following. This is the model that we chose to take, and it's taken us a while to set it up and really get it going. But, you know, we have CORE, which is now four ambulances, six SUVs, 28, I believe, healthcare professionals that have the ability to get out there in the street, establish rapport, even do street medicine, build trust, but they mitigate the pressure on EMS and really, quite honestly, on HPD and our ability to pick up people. And then we have places we bought like Evil A Center, other places where we've had land where the governor can provide tiny houses, the Kauhale. We even bought Waikiki Vista last year, which was we used for family homeless things. And that thing is working out really well. In fact, we're fully occupied. So the deal is mobile capability, mobile crisis unit can pick people up. We now have places to take people. But the biggest thing and the humane thing and why, you know, we're not having to deal with any fears, if you will, from the ACLU, for want of a better person to name or entity, is we're doing things very humanely, aggressively but humanely. We're providing wraparound services. We just had a meeting yesterday at our Behavioral Crisis Center. We now have padded rooms there. We're doing detox. If you were to go to the Ala Respite, which is the old First Hawaiian Bank across from Ala Park, and saw what goes on in there, it's fully occupied, you would see. And so these people, we're transitioning. Look, I would say of the chronic homeless that are out there, some 25 or so hundred that were out there, these are people that have been out there for a long time, oftentimes 10 years or more. All of them are suffering some kind of mental illness or drug addiction. And, you know, a lot of what we're seeing, and there's different terminologies that the psychiatrists use in describing, you know, the case counts. But a lot of these people, we've been able, because they've been off their meds, to stabilize. And
yes.
Because of schizophrenia and bipolar out there. And it's been amazing. Dr. Miskovich was just reporting yesterday, we've already moved people out to permanent supportive housing. Once we've gotten them in there, the plan is like no more than 60 days, we move them out. But there's been a number of families that have reclaimed their people, let them come back now that they have been stabilized. There's things like that that are going on that I'm almost hesitant to talk about because it feels like it's so private. But we're really in the business of helping these people. And the other thing that I'll tell you now, because we just took a meeting yesterday, our homeless meeting yesterday had six doctors in there, okay? Only one lawyer, okay? Which I'm not disparaging our lawyers, but this is really about helping people in our strategy. It was a combined meeting with the state and the city. We do that once a month, but we meet every week with some of them. This is our big meeting that we had. This is really about positive solutions and helping people.
That was Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi talking about his sense of urgency with tackling our homeless problem. We'll return to this conversation and get his thoughts on his priorities at the state legislature. Let's return to our conversation with Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi. We asked about the big issues he's facing at the state legislature. You know, there's widespread pushback on the Waihewa site selected for a new Oahu landfill. Lawmakers have ramped up efforts to revisit the decision by changing the current limitations on where the landfill can go. We get Blangiardi's latest take on this hot topic. He recounts how the Red Hill fuel threat to our aquifer changed the landscape of siting a new landfill.
That triggered more than 2 years of intense meetings with the military. And because I was dealing with Admiral Aguilino, the head of INDOPACOM, this is a surveillance of all military sites on the island of Oahu, not just Navy sites. We spent over 2 years, and Mike Formby and I were afforded incredible access to these men. And then at that time, Admiral Paparo was running the Navy fleet as well. This was taken on in part advantageous for us, because the Navy was put on the defensive, and they were looking for an opportunity to help us with this solution, okay?
Right, and the site that you had hoped to use, they deemed that not to be suitable for their needs.
Is there any other site? There were. There was one in Lualualai that is on the west side, non-starter, and the other was Bellows, non-starter. Waipiho, after a lot of exhaustive study and things that I really don't feel comfortable talking about, not that I was given top secret clearance on this, but this became a matter of national security and the kind of training that goes on in the Waipio area. We had already looked at other sites in Kalailoa to rebuild the Waipio complex. We were already into budgeting to do that, hoping we would get Waipio. So we took that real serious. So when we got that letter, it was disappointing. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking, and so we were left to make a decision. So we looked at the landscape, knowing full well that the Land Use Commission, which we had filed for an extension to make a decision, a two-year extension back in 21, it took 22 months to get a two-year extension. We now only had 2 months left. This is in November of last year. So we then looked at what was the path forward. The path forward was, would the legislature repeal Act 73, which they put into place, I believe, in 2020 or 2019, before we got into office, which created this buffer zone away from, you know, any landfill could not be within a half mile of schools, homes, hospitals, et cetera.
Right. Okay? So you need wiggle room. The city's hands are just tied.
So would they repeal Act 73 was one possibility. Or could we pick a site of the six sites? Again, it was not a bright line. It was only guidance that we felt with today's science and technology that we could build a landfill and have it be safe, because none of us want to do anything that would create anything that would even seemingly be toxic to our community, given the heightened awareness. The site we selected in Waihewa, in the middle of the Dole Field, is 150 acres, 800 feet over an aquifer. And we would have to, you know, it takes several years, 5 or 6 years to build one. We have to do road widening or whatever, mm-hmm. but it was accessible and away from everything. The closest thing to it would be Whitmore Village, a mile and a half away. Okay, this is really the middle of a good place to put it. And we proposed, if you looked at the technology that was used 35 years ago at Waimanalo Gulch, and I want to come back and make a point about Waimanalo Gulch in a moment, that technology updated to today's technology, we've not had one leak at Waimanalo Gulch. We were going to use new technology, new science, better equipment. We had a double lining. We were going to quadruple the lining. What we're proposing still is we would build, in effect, what would be considered a hazardous waste site, right, not a landfill, a hazardous waste site to protect, not the least of which is, in full EPA compliance, the pumping that we have to take care of rainwater and stuff like that. We wouldn't even go 12 inches deep, much less 800 feet. And we would be able to continuously do that, which is what we do at Waimanalo Gulch. So we proposed that, and we knew there would be some pushback, but what I didn't know is the state now looks like they're going to come in. Not only will they not repeal Act 73, which I kind of felt all along, But now they want to pass a law over there that says you can't build over an aquifer, period, irrespective of what Dr. Roger Babcock and all of us have been able to establish and prove that this thing would be more than safe. In fact, if I brought you, Catherine, or anybody in the audience listening, up to Waimanalo Gulch, knowing that 95% of what's out there is ash as a result of H-power, if you have a notion in your mind of what a landfill looks like, which is large piles of garbage, you know, with rats and seagulls.
Right, it doesn't look like that. Yeah.
There's none of that.
For a practical matter, though, some might think that the Waimanalo Gulch, you know, it has still some time on it, that we should just max that out while we build a new one. But at this juncture, you're in a tight spot.
We build a new one, yeah. Our intention was, when we named that landfill, knowing that 28 is several years away, we could have, because we have capacity to 2035 out there. We would have then, in earnest, because we selected a site on Central Oahu, we would have begun and probably filed for a short-term extension for a couple of years. But everybody, I think, would be in goodwill. They would see, okay, we're building a new landfill. We extended this a little bit. We have the capacity. It's somewhat benign out there. We're not dealing with anything that's causing any kind of problems. That was our plan. And that's only because when we came into office, there was only a seven-year window, and we had to go through the whole process, which was several years. You've heard me say before, you know, Mike, I learned the quote from Mike Bloomberg about the days are long and the years are short in this job. When it comes to something like this, or even quite honestly, for our housing, you can only operate at a certain speed given what you've got to go through. So we're trying to do this as aggressively as possible. I want to say two things, though, to your audience and to you. I'm saying this as mayor, and I would welcome for somebody to come in and say it differently to me, but nobody has. First of all, I'm not convinced that Waimanalo Gulch itself is not over an aquifer. I am not. When you look at the maps, they did a very convenient carve-out, okay? There's no way that suddenly happens, but that was done 35 years ago, okay? Secondly, for all that I heard about how dare we put anything over an aquifer, especially anything that might involve fuels and all the stuff that went on with Red Hill, understood. We have gas tanks all over this island, all over this island. Now, they're EPA compliant, they're double lined, but you want to talk about the very fact that we have that. Nobody wants to talk about that.
Right, the risk. You know,
there's
and the
an
threat.
Acceptance of that. Yet we come forward and say, this thing is in North Waiwa, in the middle of a field, okay, 98. We can build a 21st century with the best technology, 800 feet over an aquifer landfill, knowing that we have H power on top of that, and nobody wants to buy that. That, to me, is illogical. And what I don't like about this is we're being forced to turn out there at the west side and say, through every effort we've made, we have no choice. They would not repeal Act 73. They've now passed laws. You can't go over an aquifer than to stay out there. Our whole intention was about social equity. And what I've made a promise to people on the west side, that they had done their time, they'd served it for 35 years, and we're going to move it to a different location. So we're being more than backed into a corner. We're being backed into a situation where we have no choice but to accept what they then legislate.
Yeah.
And I will tell you this. It is so wrong to say what we want to do is Red Hill 2. That is so wrong. That is unfair, and it's wrong. And to create that kind of fear in people, to me, from a governance standpoint, as mayor, responsible for the people in our community, that's a below-the-belt punch. And look, I've been really clear. I really like Ernie Lau, and I've made it very public with him that we're opponents philosophically on this issue, but we're not adversaries.
Mm-hmm.
But I would tell you, the labeling of Red Hill 2 for what we want to do in Waiwa is a mischaracterization of the highest order.
That was Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi talking about his priorities with the state legislature and the fate of Oahu's much-needed landfill. A measure to prohibit landfills over aquifers awaits a vote and could upend the current site selection. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. On today's Manu Minute, we've got the scratchy calls of a common game bird, thanks to the Makaule Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology for these recordings of black francolins. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Black francolins are a plump partridge that stand a little more than a foot tall. Male black Franklins are particularly striking, with a jet black breast and head and a bright white patch below the eye, cinnamon-colored neck, and zebra-like striping on their backs. Given their strong legs, they're mostly cursorial, meaning they spend much of their time on the ground. But at the sign of danger, they use their short, rounded wings, along with strong breast muscles, for fast but short bursts of flight. Their calls are given only by males and can be heard throughout the year. They usually climb up to the highest nearby perch, like a fence post or a tree branch, stretch their neck up, throw their head backwards, and let out a series of four or five loud, scratchy, metallic syllables. Black Franklins are naturally found from northern India all the way to the Mediterranean. They were introduced to several U.S. states, and also Hawaii, in the 50s and 60s for hunting, but Hawaii is the only place where they survive, likely because there's fewer predators here than other places. In the few decades since their arrival, they've become common game birds on the dry leeward sides of all the main Hawaiian islands. Black Franklins spend most of their time in woodlands and grasslands, where they hunt for insects, seeds, and fruits. One of our fears with introduced birds that eat fruits is that they'll help spread the seeds of invasive plant species into new areas. However, a recent study in Hawaii has shown that for partridges like black Franklins, most seeds they consume don't survive passage through their gut, so they likely don't contribute much to the spread of invasive plant species here. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, committed to helping preserve, protect, and restore the biological diversity of Hawaii Island. Friendsofhakalauforest.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how Elon Musk got and is using the power to cut jobs slash federal funding and help place people close to him in government positions. What influence are other tech billionaires having on the Trump administration? We'll talk with New York Times reporter Teddy Schleifer, who covers the intersection of Washington's players and tech titans. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
The competition was stiff. Consider that 475 people applied for 30 slots to train as physician assistants. It's a new program at Hawaii Pacific University that rolled out last month. The program aims to address our community's health care needs. Hawaii is estimated to be short some 600 to 700 doctors, and this new training program will help to fill the gap. We talked to Program Director Leocadia Conlon. We talked to Program Director Leocadia Conlon recently. HPU started both a physical therapy and occupational therapy program, and we asked what makes a physician assistant program a must for Hawaii.
So I think the best way to handle that is to take a trip back to the late 1960s when the profession was started. And it was started by physicians to respond to, I think, two things that were going on at that time that really created gaps in care or more needs in care. One of it was the creation of Medicare and Medicaid in the 1960s, that then we had millions of more people with insurance that did not have health care providers. The second one, there was such an increase in medical technology that physicians had to leave their practices to go get trained somewhere, right? This was not a time of Zoom and other ways of getting training. And so physicians were already being innovative and training non-physician people in their practice to help when they weren't there. And so this model was really created as seeing a need and needing to create someone who is in the likeness, if you will, of a physician that can work side by side with a physician to do duties that would otherwise be carried out by the physician. So that's what you'll see now in PA practice. The training, or the education rather, for PAs is based on the medical school curriculum. So it has allowed the profession to be nimble over time to respond to the needs. For example, in the early 2000s, there were new regulations put in place around medical residents and the amount of hours that they could work. That really created an increase of need for providers in the hospital. And so PAs stepped up, and now we have a big specialty of PAs who work in hospitalist care as inpatient medicine providers. I can give you many points throughout the history where PAs have really adapted to what the needs are in medicine. And that is really what we do. We fill gaps in care, but the important thing I want to point out is we fill gaps in care in partnership with a physician. So you will always see a PA working, whether it's with a group of physicians or it's one physician in a practice, PAs are working closely with that physician. But when you see a PA in practice, and of course, the amount of independence or autonomy they have will depend on their experience, but you're going to see them performing duties that would otherwise be performed by a physician. But again, in that agreement and close collaboration with that physician.
Do we have a sense as to what our need is here in Hawaii?
Yeah, I think, you know, the reports that come out about our physician workforce shortages is about, you know, we have a gap of about 700 physicians, but that really spans through primary care and specialty care. So I think when you hear people talk about PAs, you will hear a lot of need in primary care, and absolutely we do have that need. But I think maybe what isn't well known or we don't know enough about is how many PAs we might need in specialty care, especially when you talk about the fact that they can extend the care of that physician to maybe neighbor island clinics or clinics in more rural areas of some of our islands. So I think that we have a good sense in general that we do need more primary care, but I think that we need a lot more specialty care than we might realize.
And so how long is this training program?
It's 24 months. You know, again, the PA education is based on the medical school curriculum. So very general training, meaning general training that they go through all the areas of medicine. So even when they do their clinical rotation year, they are rotating through 7 core areas of hands-on clinical experience, and it amounts to over 2,000 hours of hands-on clinical experience. So that when they graduate, they have a strong foundation to either go into primary care practice or go into a specialty practice with the understanding that, of course, they're going to get more on-the-job training with that specialty provider they're working with. Now, what you said about being able to figure out if it's the right place for them, that is the one thing that's unique to the PA profession. PAs can, and there are some specialty fellowships and residency programs in the nation, but they don't have to. So they can be flexible or nimble and rotate to different areas of medicine. It might not just be because they figured out it wasn't what they wanted. It might be because they found that there was another area of need that they really feel maybe they have the skill set or the interest in pursuing. And then I think also it's just finding that right practice, too, that has a good, strong physician and PA relationship.
What would the starting pay be for a physician's assistant?
So the starting pay for a physician assistant nationally is around $100,000. PA school is expensive, 24 months straight through, so it's 6 semesters. Tuition is costly. So luckily, we do have programs like what the governor put in place for loan repayment for providers that practice in Hawaii. So that's what we really hope, that, you know, our graduates will stay here and will practice in Hawaii, and they would potentially get that loan repayment benefit.
And is there anything else that you think might set this apart from any other similar program on the mainland?
The other thing that HPU committed to when we started these graduate health science programs is to be innovative in our delivery model. These programs, like the PA program, like I said, it's really intense, it's straight through. And their traditional model is you're sitting in a classroom for 8 hours a day, listening to lecture after lecture. And, you know, we know so much more now about learning. And there was really a deep dive into, well, what really is adult learning in a, you know, such an intense graduate program. So the university put in place a framework for us to have a hybrid graduate health science program. So it's low residency, where for our program, specifically the PA program, students are only on campus their didactic year about once a semester. So then the other times they are remote learners. They are still really intense weeks. It is still a full-time week, but it allows us to put variety into the learning modules. So they have a mixture of asynchronous and synchronous activities. We do things that really try to respond to different learning preferences, different learning styles. And then when we come together once a semester, it is a really intense focus on those hands-on physical exam and clinical skills. And that is a big difference. I think that sets us apart from other programs in the U.S. You will find a couple programs in the U.S. There's about a handful that have this hybrid type learning environment. What really sets us apart from them, though, is we are the first program that started our program that way. The other PA programs that have programs like that, they already had a in-person brick-and-mortar program, and then they started a second online program where they kind of flipped that material online. Versus us, we started this way with a lot of intentionality around what does it mean to have hybrid learning to ensure that we're maximizing that for learning and getting to different learning preferences and ensuring that we're offering really high-quality education. And then, of course, their clinical year is unchanged. They are in a clinic or a hospital for their clinical rotations.
And then, gosh, is there anything you can share with our listeners about this cohort?
I first want to share that we have this phenomenal faculty and staff that is just 100% committed to this program and the mission. And we found the students that are just in the same way. They see this as a legacy, the impact they're going to make. The majority of our students are from Hawaii. 26 out of the 30 students are from Hawaii. 21 of our students come from disadvantaged backgrounds. And I say that because that's an important point where a lot of these students are first-generation college students, and now they're going on to get a graduate degree in a health profession. 5 of our students are Native Hawaiian, and we also have a huge focus in our program on not only a mission to serve Hawaii, but also a focus on Native Hawaiian health and healthcare needs that are unique to Hawaii.
That was Leocadia Conlon, director of the new Physician's Assistant Program that's being started by Hawaii Pacific University. The only other PA program in the state is a satellite campus in Kona, started by University of Washington. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to focus on Mary Kawenapukui, Native Hawaiian educator and scholar who is featured in a new Keiki book. Leave your feedback on our show on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.